It does. It's special revenue, and it doesn't go into.
Oh, no. Oh, I thought you said. Okay, fine. All right. Okay, let's begin. I think the first bill we have on the agenda, if he's here, is Senator Day. And I guess there's a division report. I don't see Senator Berglund. Senator Pappas moves adoption of the division report. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. Senator Day and...
Mr. Chairman, thank you for hearing our bill, and this went through Senator Berglund's committee, and there isn't much of a fiscal problem, but that being said, this is the Steele County Communities for a Lifetime proposal. It's a pilot project, an initiative that implements 15 years of state policy direction relative to long-term care options, and the project is strongly aligned with the Department of Human Services 2010 and 2030 initiatives seeking to downsize nursing home components of the state delivery system. And with me I have a former representative, Tom Shea, now a Commissioner Tom Shea, Steele County. And he could maybe explain a little bit of the project, but we're basically here because of a fiscal note. But Senator Berglund, I don't see her here. She basically was telling me yesterday that she doesn't really know if there's a fiscal note or not. I don't know, I guess your people will know that. If there is one, it's
certainly there is one in the packets that indicates, I think, no general fund fiscal impact. Now, I believe there's a slight impact in 2012. Is that correct, Mr. Mossman?
Mr. Chair and members, if you look at the fiscal note and Senator Day on page 3, there would be a number of adjustments that would be allowed to rate adjustments when the new nursing facility is in place in Steele County. The understanding in putting the fiscal note together is that the timeline for the project is about 3 years out. So there is, if you look at about two-thirds of the way down the middle of page 3, there's a reference to it, $128,000. So there would be the fiscal impact of $128,000, but not beginning until essentially fiscal year 12. Based on the timeline that the county is expecting for the project.
Okay. Commissioner Shea, welcome to the committee. And there's nobody else you served with, I think, around the table other than
Senator Stumpf.
Oh, Senator Stumpf, yeah, from many years ago. Yeah. That's right. You were elected together with him,
correct.
Right? Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman of the committee. Steele County is one of only seven counties in the state that owns and operates a nursing home, and we're very proud of the fact that we've been profitable, meaning we haven't used direct property tax dollars to subsidize their nursing home. But at the same time, we know that is not, we don't have a sustainable model. And rather than waiting for a crisis to develop, we wanted to look ahead and we wanted to be proactive. We also understood that it's not a prime core competency of county government to operate nursing homes. And so what we're proposing to do is create a new community nonprofit organization, partner with the Benedictine Health System to operate and manage a brand new nursing home in Steele County, downsize our existing nursing home from 108 beds to 80 beds, and build a new facility on the brand new healthcare campus in Owatonna, which has a brand-new Alina Hospital, which is currently under construction, a brand-new Mayo Health System where the physicians are located. And so we'd all be three located on the same campus and physically connected in a building. The reason we're able to do this is because we're utilizing our Communities for a Lifetime initiative where we implement a continuum of care for all the elderly services that we have available in our county. And we hope to demonstrate through this pilot that fiscal impact that's identified here will actually be zero by better leveraging the services that we have and better utilizing those both for the for patient care as well as for bringing some economies and efficiencies to the process. So with that, I appreciate the leadership of Senator Day in helping us and Senator Berglund hearing it in her committee, and we'd appreciate your support so that we can move this forward.
Okay. Questions from members for either Senator Roebling?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is very similar to a project that was done in Shakopee, also
yes.
by the Benedictine system. And they actually closed a nursing home in Jordan and moved the beds over to Shakopee with another existing nursing home. And members, it is a wonderful facility. I am so proud of it. It's attached to the hospital. It has assisted living units. It has the long-term care. And one thing that we have really found out about that facility is that they have a major rehab component to it that has been becoming wildly popular with long, long waiting lists of people who are coming out of the hospital that have had hip and knee replacements, and they have a very large physical therapy department. And this is for these baby boomers, namely us, who will be needing these services soon. And as a result of the therapy that they get in the short-term stay, actually, there's a number of beds that are designated for that, they are able to keep those people out of long-term care. And I just have seen some marvelous results there, and I'm assuming that this facility will be very similar to that. And I think that in the long term, we will save a lot of money
yes.
because these facilities really are working well. And I think that, I mean, we're going to see them and hold them up as best practices of how healthcare can and how this physical therapy can really help people speed up their recoveries and go back home again.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Stump.
Thank you. It's nice to see that there's life after the legislature.
Yes, thank you.
Representative Shea and I were two of the original WITTICs over in the House. I forget how many were there, about seven of us? Or?
Well, it depends on the year, I guess. That's
it was quite a few years ago. It is nice to see that you're doing some active work down in the Owatonna area. Mr. Chairman, I don't have a question or anything, but I'd be happy to move Senate File 3638 when it's appropriate to do so.
Mr. Chair?
Sarah Olson.
I think somebody needs to have a definition of wood ticks.
I could offer a definition.
Well, Congress has its blue dogs. And the House used to have its wood ticks.
Sarah Olson, listen to this. For the year, I was with former Representative Shea, I was the urban wood tick.
Yes.
And
you're kidding.
Am I right?
Yes, you are, Senator.
And that was a group of legislators, although it ended up being fairly significant, and a lot more than just myself, seeking workers' compensation reform. That was my old days. And so that's at least that. When I came back to the House, you were here in the Senate, but those were the wood ticks in the House when I was there. So there were pro-business legislators in the House.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Sorry, Senator Pappas.
Yeah, but, Mr. Chair, I knew that, but I was doing some lip reading here.
Thank you, Mr.
So,
Chair.
So much for old legislative history. Further questions for either Senator Day or Commissioner Shea?
Yes.
Further questions?
Mr. Chairman, I would move the committee report or the division report.
Moved the division report. So
then I'd move Senate File 3638 be recommended to be passed and re-referred to the floor.
Okay. On the Stumpf motion, is there further discussion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, next we have Senate File 1128, Senator Erickson Ropes. Is there a...
It's a good bill.
Senator Pappas moves adoption of the division report. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. Senator Erickson Ropes.
Thank you. And, Mr. Chair, is that division report the new amendment?
Well, apparently there's no, the amendment's separate from the division report.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have an amendment that's just being passed out that needs to be adopted.
Move the amendment when we're ready. Elite line 9 through 11. Dennis,
it's 211.
It looks like we're deleting the new language in the division report with this and putting in different language.
Yes, Mr. Chair, at the last committee we presented this bill to, it was Senator Betzold's committee on state and local government, and we had added this section that you see before you on the division report. And in order to get the support of the Chamber of Commerce, who's now neutral, they preferred this language that you see before you in the amendment. It's just a clearer version of that amendment.
Well, Senator Erickson Ropes, because we're amending, your amendment amends the division report. I think what I'd like to do is maybe have some discussion about the bill first before we take up the amendment.
Okay. All right. That'd be great. This is a bill I've been working on for 2 years with the Alzheimer's Association and AARP and also the Consortium for Citizens with Disabilities. And this is a provision that simply allows people to use their sick leave for family members that are beyond the spouse, themselves, and a child. And we are not creating new language as far as giving more sick leave. It's just the sick leave that's in the bank for an employee. We would like them to be able to use that sick leave for an aging parent or to accompany their sister to cancer treatments, or if they have a step-parent that they're caring for, that they would be allowed to use their accrued sick leave for extended family members. That's all this bill does. We are living in an age, especially in our healthcare communities, where we're trying to provide for keeping families in their homes longer, and we're moving to trying to have more family-based support and community-based support that keeps people out of long-term care situations. And in order to do that, one of the pieces are looking at the working children and creating policies that would be more flexible at the workplace to allow employees to take a day off for their aging parent, for example. And that's what this bill does.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Stump.
Senator Ropes, is one of the states besides here in Minnesota
where they do the bargain?
North Dakota, does North Dakota, one of the 32 states?
I'm going to have to look.
Iris Freeman with the Alzheimer's Association is checking that list, Senator.
Sure.
Sure. If I might, Mr. Chairman and Senator the resource I'm using
Ms. Freeman, if you could identify yourself for the
Iris
record.
Iris Freeman for the Alzheimer's Association. The legal research on states, 32 states that have some form of sick leave for adult caregiving on the books, is a list that does include the state of North Dakota. North Dakota also has a tax credit for family caregivers, which Minnesota hasn't yet achieved.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Metzen.
Oh, thank you. I got here a little late.
These benefits are for what groups of people? I mean, I'd share that LAC, and we do, and we, you know, Doer does a negotiating, and I carried that bill to for, I believe it was 3.25. Well, it doesn't matter what it was, but all the departments, as you know, a couple of weeks ago on the Senate floor, and it passed almost unanimously. I was wondering, how does this get into those areas? And in other words, I should probably know about this in the committee that we, that I chair with Carla Bigham from the House. Is this overlapping, or did you tell me about this and I forgot? I don't think that could happen.
Do you want me to go ahead?
Does that make sense? I mean, yes. Isn't this stuff that the different agencies bargain with the units?
Right. Mr. Chair, members, I'm Heidi Holstein with AARP. This bill has been through a number of committees in the Senate, including your committee. However, it didn't have the amendment that we're actually trying to replace today. But
I didn't, Mr. Chair, I haven't seen the amendment, so that's maybe right. What I'm missing.
Yeah.
Here,
the amendment that we adopted essentially eliminated the fiscal note for the state of Minnesota. There was an approximately $11 million fiscal note, and we Iris Freeman and I met with the Doer folks over the summer, the labor negotiators, and said, you know, this is something that we strongly support. What can we do to get it done? And Paul Larson was the person we met with, and he said, well, you could exempt Doer. And we weren't quite comfortable with that specific of a strategy. So what we ended up doing is we came up with language that said, if you have a policy or a labor agreement in place that already covers these categories of people, you will essentially be exempt from this new requirement. So we understand that with the amendment as it's written, if an employer allows you to take only 1 hour of your sick leave to care for your grandma, for example, this amendment would cover you. So it's not an all-out coverage as the initial bill was, but it does eliminate the fiscal note for the Department of Employee Relations.
Chairman, I'm not arguing at all, but it's not the policy so much as I think that the steps that should have been taken to get to here. And maybe it just got done, and maybe this is an exception to the rule, but I think we understand one another.
Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, this is for other employers other than the state, right? This is for all employers in the state, but you were just the amendment is a way to get around the fiscal note that you were presented with. Isn't that right?
Right, Mr. Chair, Senator Higgins. The amendment would impact all employers, but the effect of it is to, as far as the fiscal side of it, is to eliminate the fiscal note. But it also would say that if an employer has a policy currently in place or has a labor agreement, it would exempt them as well.
But, Mr. Chair and Ms. Holstein, the employer could always choose to do this. You're just saying that you're not mandating them if they under those circumstances.
Mr. Chair, Senator Higgins, that's correct.
Senator Roblin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But even though we got rid of the state fiscal note, there's still a significant local impact fiscal note in here. I think it says on page one of this letter from the Department of Finance, an estimated statewide cost to local governments of $26 million in fiscal year 2009 was calculated. And so we could be passing this on to another unit of government that may or not be prepared. And on the next page, it explains why. It says that local governments will experience an increase in sick leave usage, but that's not a problem if they don't have to have a replacement. But if they do have to have a replacement for people taking sick leave, an example would be police officers, firefighters, and correction workers, then it will cost local governments a fairly significant amount. And the question that I ask, which is somewhat related to what Senator Metzen was asking about, is should not this be negotiated in labor contracts? We're just giving this as a benefit here without a contract. And I'm not saying the local governments would necessarily fight it if the unions came in and requested it, but we're saying that they have to do it if they haven't done it already. And I don't know if that's something that we should be doing to local governments.
Mr. Chair?
Sarah Higgins.
Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling, we're not telling the local governments they have to give any more days for sick days. We're just telling them that if the employees get sick days, they can use them to take care of their elderly parent or another family member. Right. We're not saying that they're getting any more sick days. Mm-hmm. That would be what I would think would trigger a fiscal note. This is just saying that you can actually use them.
Well, Mr. Chair,
they must figure
Mr. Roebling.
But traditionally, they have not. But because it's been for your own illness, basically, or for your children's or your spouse's, and this is expanding it to others. And so the sick days are given to you for your own immediate family. But I guess I understand their concern when they have to hire a replacement. If it's an office worker whose absence can occur for a few days without bringing in a replacement, then they're saying there's no extra cost. But when it's a police officer or someone working at the county jail, certainly they do incur extra costs the more we expand this.
Mr. Chairman?
Okay.
Now, I'm not sure what contracts at the local government are, but if you look at the last sentence on page 3 of 4 of that letter from finance, it says that another consideration that's not quantified here is the possibility that increased usage of sick leave as a result of this bill would result in less sick time being paid out for departing employees. This could lead to savings in the long run. So is it a common practice to pay departing employees for their unused sick leave?
Yes.
See, if that is the case, then it really would be a wash if they leave versus using it.
Good point.
Senator Erickson-Ropes, you want to have a comment? Somebody's asked for the opportunity to testify, but go ahead.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senator Roebling, for the questions. I just wanted to respond to the local impact note itself and just say that I think this is a little off base. I'm not sure if I completely trust the dollar amount attached here. I want everyone to keep in mind we're just giving people permission to use their own sick leave for a family member, and that's all this bill does. Now, in fact, actually, I think what's practically happening on a local level is that people may just call in and cough, you know, and say they're sick because they have to take their parent to a doctor's appointment. And this just gives people, you know, a way to not have to call in and lie about their time off, for one thing. I did have a concern about the local impact note, and that note actually came after the last committee we had, just before coming to this committee. So after 2 years of working on this, we had never experienced any concern about local impact until about a week ago or 2 weeks ago. I asked Jim Showalter, who is the budget director for the Department of Finance, and two of his staff people to come to my office, as well as Heidi Holte and Iris Freeman and my staff member, to ask about how the local impact notes are put together. And I needed to understand this. And in Mr. Showalter's own words, he says they're extremely vague. And they sent out a statewide survey across Minnesota and got 15 responses back. They heard from 4 cities. And based on the information that they got, they backed into this number, and they just plugged numbers into a formula that they created and extrapolated it out for the entire state. So I think that if we get to a point in our legislative discernment where we are looking seriously at local impact notes, and we should, because we should be very aware of costs we're passing on to local governments, we have to be really in a position where we find these notes credible. And I think if you talk to the members that did them, they would say they need more resources in terms of staff and time in order to get really accurate numbers. So this is it's a very vague number, and I would hate to hang my hat on this in terms of disallowing families to give care to their sick family members just because of a wobbly fiscal note.
Mr. Chairman.
Sarah Foley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Earlier you discussed the absenteeism and the problem in connection with that, but having spent 33 years as a state employee in the State Highway Patrol, we never called in for any kind of a replacement or anything like that. And my guess today is the same thing, that when one of those troopers gets sick, there's nobody replacing them. It's just one less person out there. That's all it is. And so I think that's kind of a false premise that we're basing it on something that really isn't happening. Now, if you're looking at a nurse or something in a hospital room, that might be different. But generally speaking, in state employees, they don't have a backfilling, if you will.
Thank you.
Chairman.
Senator Stump.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Help me out with this. The first lines 4 and 5, where it says this section does not prevent an employer from providing greater sick leave benefits than are provided for under this section. Then what seems to me the next 4 words are what really neuters the not only the cost, but actually the it seems like the content of the bill, and that is, nor does it alter. Okay, so it means it's not going to change any employer's existing policies relating to sick leave or labor agreements.
Keep reading.
Does, yeah, that allow the use of sick leave for the care of a child? So what does this do in terms of those employers that have a policy? Nothing?
Ms. Freeman.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Stumpf, again, Iris Freeman from the Alzheimer's Association. The intent of this new amendment is to say we aren't trying to prevent anyone from arguing for more than is in the bill. If some employer and employee group want to say there's going to be a separate whole bank of leave for family care, go for it. This law doesn't prevent it. It doesn't mandate it. The second part of the amendment started with our conversation with the Department of Employee Relations, and its intent is to say to governmental units, to private employers, if you're already doing something that pretty well meets the intent of this bill, you don't have to do anything else.
So who, Mr. Chairman, who actually is impacted? If I understand this correctly, and I may have to refer to Senate counsel, but anybody that has any employer that has a policy, they're not impacted. Anybody that doesn't have a policy, they're not impacted either because they don't have a policy, right?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator, if an employer doesn't grant sick leave, this bill isn't about them. It doesn't
right.
create
so that
sick leave.
That takes those employers off of the around. Table.
And if you have policies or labor agreements that look pretty much like this,
they're off.
So the only segment that would be affected by this new law are those employers of whatever type who do have sick leave that their employers are permitted to use under current law for their own sicknesses or their sick or injured children. This law would say to those employers and employees, now you can use it to take mom for admission to that facility that was being discussed in the last bill.
But aren't they exempt? Because it says, nor does it alter an employer's existing sick leave policy.
Chairman, Senator, that is colored by the rest of the sentence.
So, Mr. Chair?
Sarah Olson.
Mr. Chair, maybe they have the policy that just now allows for taking care of a child. It would be altered, because this says if they have that allow the use of sick leave for all of these individuals, and that's what you're essentially attempting to do, is that we now have it for children in the state law, mm-hmm. and you're trying to expand it to these other categories of relationship.
Mr. Chair, I think Senator Stumpf points to some of the troubles that we've been having with different departments and groups trying to get to common language where everyone understands the intent, but trying to get it into paper between the ands and the ors and the clauses, it's difficult because we are adopting, or I have this amendment before you right now, and this is language that the chamber agrees to and will make them feel comfortable in terms of the businesses across the state to a point where the chamber is neutral now on this bill, whereas before they were opposed to it. So different people want to see this language phrased in different ways. We think this is clear, although Senator Stumpf still points out that there's different ways you can interpret what's before you.
Senator Dill.
And we'll work on it.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Erickson-Robes, the term grandparent, could that mean all kinds of different types of grandparents, like great-grandparents, great-great-grandparents, step-great-grandparents, and so on?
Mr. Chair and Senator Dill, the way I read this bill, it says grandparent.
Maybe this would be an opportunity. We've had a request for testimony from Ms. O'Rourke.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Tomasoni. Well,
Mr. Chairman, the way I read the bill and the amendment, it says, all it says is that if you give sick leave currently, we're going to expand it to the spouse, sibling, parent, grandparent, or step-parent. We're not going to give you any more sick leave, but you can use it for those purposes. And if you already use it for those purposes, we're not going to make you do anything extra. And it's pretty straightforward in that it's just trying to make sure that sick leave is granted for more purposes than just yourself and the child. And in addition, it seems to me that the fiscal note that was presented here can't be accurate because we're not granting more sick leave to anybody. We're just allowing it to be used for different purposes, and there's no saying that just because it's used for different purposes that it's going to cost more and that there's going to be more people using it more often. So I think it's just a better way to get at what people are probably already doing by saying, I'm sick because I got to take my mother to the hospital.
Thank you, Senator Tomasoni. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Ms. O'Rourke, did you...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jennifer O'Rourke with the League of Minnesota Cities, and regrettably, we need to be on record testifying against this bill again today. Keith Carlson with the County Association, MICA has testified against this bill as well, and I don't think he could be here yet this afternoon. Most of you have raised a number of really good issues with this bill that a lot of my points have already been made, especially to the points of local control and the fiscal issues that come forward in the fiscal note. I would just add that I agree that there is probably a high cost with that fiscal note. The part that relates to cities is exactly about $24 million. And I would just challenge you to, as you think about moving this bill forward and whether or not that happens, that maybe there still is a cost to this for local units of government, whether that's $24 million or whether it's something more like $15 or $20 million. But we've had this bill out in front of our own members for about 2 years now, as long as it's been part of the record. And we've had lots and lots of HR folks weigh in on this bill, troubled by the local control aspect. For instance, a lot of them are in negotiations right now or working towards more of a paid time off aspect for a benefit for their members. This would preempt that, if you will, by mandating that the benefits go a lot further than what they currently do by expanding it to all these other family groups. I think that's all I need to cover today. If there's anything else, I'm here for questions.
Thank you. Senator Roblin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was reading this two of four on the fiscal note. And at the top it said it wasn't a statewide survey. They sent out samples to 13 cities and 17 counties with the questions that are listed here. Five cities responded in 10 counties. And then they, based on that, were their calculations for this fiscal note. And this kind of goes to, I believe, what Senator Stumpf was saying, that of the 10 counties that responded to the request, three stated that they did not have any policies in place to allow for the use of sick leave for a family member, while seven counties reported having a sick leave policy in place that included or partially included the care of family members, which are listed in here. And so that's where they were getting that fiscal note. And the same was true with the cities. Two cities responded that they didn't have policies in place that were similar to what we're talking about today, and three said they did have. But I'm wondering, what will we consider similar enough? Suppose current law apparently says it's just for the employee and the employee's child. So if they've already added spouse, but they haven't added parent or grandparent or sibling, is that similar enough? And if you don't allow your employees this, what is the consequence for a city or a county that wouldn't do it? So what's close enough?
You'd be breaking the law if you didn't.
Is it all or just one?
Senator Exum-Ropes, do you?
I would say we put the law out there as we do with many things, and we let the cities and counties make the decisions that they do and deal with it as we move forward.
Any questions for Ms. O'Rourke? Okay. Senator Anderson?
Well, Mr. Chair, I apologize for arriving a little bit late. My working group was meeting. We just finished. It just doesn't make any sense to me that local governments under current law, let me take away all those double and triple negatives. It makes sense that currently, you know, in your existing budget, you would budget for the number of sick days that each employee has. And if you budget for that number of days rather than how many days you think they might take, then, you know, you have to be budgeting based on your employee gets 1 week of paid sick days or 2 weeks of paid sick days or 3 days of paid sick days. That's what the status quo is, and this bill won't change that. You're still, each employee is still going to have the same number of sick days under law and under their, whatever their agreement is with their local government under this law. It's just a matter of whether they're going to use it or not. I think your assumption is that they're going to actually start using their sick days that they're not using. And that means you're not budgeting for them to get sick. And that just isn't responsible to me. I don't understand why we would say we would base a fiscal note on an inaccurate assumption. Mm-hmm. If local government is assuming they're not using their sick days, then you should tell us that. Because if you're assuming they're going to replace all these people, well, they're already entitled to do that, and they already could be taking all those days. So it just doesn't make sense to me, this fiscal.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, and this is kind of along the line that Senator Anderson was talking about, and I think maybe we overlook a couple things. One is, you know, most of the employees at the county and city level are in a union of some sort, and they have representation. They've all under contract. In those contracts, most of the time, it has a very defined set of benefits, whether it's, you know, your retirement or your sick leave or whatever it is. And most of the time, they'll say, okay, you get 10 days of casual sick leave. And then most of the time they'll kick it up and they'll let you, you know, if you're an employee and you go in for appendicitis and it's something that lasts 3 weeks that you're off work, most communities will cover that employee, even though the defined by the contract says, you know, you only get 10 days. But they'll move the cap. There's others that don't have that. And that's kind of where Senator Anderson, I think you were alluding to, you know, in those where they're all defined, the city would not be managing their money, in my opinion, in a fiscally prudent manner unless they did exactly what you said. Okay, we've got 500 employees. They all get 10 days. That's X amount of hours, and this is the way it goes. But there's some of those that aren't, that don't have that. And, you know, we also forget about the point, and I think Senator Foley was starting to talk about that a little bit, and that's what happens when, you know, all of a sudden there's going to be employee X is going to be out for 5 days in a row, and it is a position that has to be filled. And somebody has to come in and work overtime. That's increased cost to the city or county or township, whatever. If they don't, then it's not a big deal. I mean, you know, you're not paying overtime wages, and, you know, when the employee gets back, they can get their work caught up. It's not a big deal. I don't believe that the fiscal note is accurate in portraying what the true cost is. I think it would be something south of this $24 million or whatever they're talking about, way south, in my opinion.
South is the less?
Less. South is less.
Well,
ask Mississippi. My point is that I don't think the fiscal concern is all that much. I really don't. I don't see this costing $24 million. I don't see it costing 15 or even 10. But what I do see is that in those instances where you have a smaller community that everybody knows everybody, and you know, employee X has a sick parent and they're going to be out for a month, there's not one person that's working in that shop that's not going to carry an extra bucket of water to help that family out. And that's exactly what we're doing here. I don't even know why we're arguing about this. This is like the commercial where all the firefighters are in City Hall, and the chief holds up a big manual, and it says here we need clean water. Is everybody in favor of that? Yeah, bang. Bangs the gavel, throws that one down, picks up the next one. We need good roads. Everybody for good roads? Yeah, bang. We need this. I think we just hold it up and bang the gavel and move along.
Okay.
This makes sense.
What we're actually going to do is lay the bill over for a few minutes. Senator Vickerman has to leave within a half hour or so. I promised Senator Vickerman we'd get to his bill this afternoon. So, Senator Erickson Ropes, I apologize, but we'll pick the bill up as soon as we're done with Senator Vickerman, if that's okay. Senator Vickerman? And Senator Vickerman is coming up to the witness table on Senate File 2462. There is no division report, so we can proceed with a discussion of the bill.
That's what we're good at.
Got to rock and roll.
They can do this.
Mm-hmm. As much as I love you, Troy. I got
you. Maybe.
Is it?
Peter, is this a...
Okay. Fiscal note points out cabinet has no involvement.
Okay. All right, Senator Vickerman, Senate File 2462, and to help matters, there's an amendment being distributed, the A1 amendment, apparently pointed out by Finance that the Department of Administration has nothing to do with this bill, so it just eliminates administration. Let's wait till the amendment's been distributed.
That's all I have. Mr. Chair, thank you personally for allowing me to move ahead. I have another working group that we have to get to, and I also want to thank you for giving me some time so that the commissioners from down in Laverne could make it up here, and that's why I put it towards the end, so be sure they would be able to make it, because they can explain it a lot better, a lot easier than I can. I know what the amendment is, and I will offer it just to put the bill in order that it should be in.
Yeah, again, this is a technical, or not a technical amendment, but an amendment to make sure the bill is done properly without admin involved. Senator Vickerman moves adoption of the A1 amendment. Is there a discussion on the amendment? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. Senator Vickerman.
Mr. Chair, then I will ask this gentleman here to kind of go through briefly. I know you've got a shortage of time, but just kind of explain what it does.
Mr. Chair, my name is Kyle Older. I'm the Rock County Administrator and also a member of the Buffalo Ridge Rail Authority. Apologize for the voice. It's cold season. What we're asking is that a 20-year-old loan and acquisition loan and rehab loan be forgiven. The loan was put in place in 1989. To date, nothing has been paid to the state. We do have our current shipper is here, our operator, if you will, is the Minnesota Southern Railways, Brent Polinchek. When the loan was given to Rock and Nobles County together, as the association, we were hauling grain by rail. The line is a short line, 41 miles long. It connects the Union Pacific to the Burlington Northern, bridges the two lines, and we were able to ship both ways. But as agriculture has evolved, the grain traffic on that line dried up. But we were fortunate in the late 1990s to pick up an ethanol plant in Laverne, and the ethanol transports 97% of all of their ethanol by rail either to the Burlington Northern or to the Union Pacific. However, the car traffic is such that it doesn't generate enough volume to pay back the rehab and acquisition loan. The line is vital. We don't want to lose sight on that. That line is imperative that we keep it and continue to operate, but we're not generating the necessary revenues to pay back the loan. The two counties, Nobles County and Rock County, along with the Shippers Association, have all forgiven the loan to the authority. The remaining holder of the note or of the debt is the state, and we are requesting that the state also forgive those loans. And we feel what that will do is allow us to pursue some rehab without having the debt hanging over our head to try to make the line even better than what it is. We do need the line. We don't want to think for a minute that that line can be anything other than a rail line, because without it, that ethanol transporting would go back over roads, and we don't need that. We need to continue to haul it by rail. So it's a vital part of our agricultural community. But it's just instead of shipping the 3,000 cars that were estimated by the counties and MnDOT in the late 80s, we're in that neighborhood of 900 to 1,000 cars per year. So we're continuing to operate, just not at the volume that was anticipated when the loan was originally laid out.
Well, Mr. Chair, I've done a little homework, and one railroad car hauls about four semis. So you add up the numbers, you can see there's no way you could get enough semis on the road to move the ethanol. It has to be moved. I would say it has to be moved by rail. We're not asking for any new money, just forgiving the loan, and we've done that before in different circumstances. So it's very important to that rural district that we help them keep this railroad going. It's not easy. The gentleman here runs the operation. He's handicapped. It's not easy. Not easy.
Sarah Olson. Or Sarah Pearson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to ask anybody at the table, I see that it's going to be rehabbed, and how long might it take for that 41 miles of rehab, whatever it takes, to be complete, considering you must use the rails in the between time?
Mr. Chair, Senator, it was rehabbed in 1989. So the rehab,
this is
it's
completed.
Done. Yep, that's been completed. The operator now, Minnesota Southern, they continue to do maintenance, but the rehab was done as part of the acquisition and rehab loans of 1989.
Thank you.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, and Senator Rickman, okay, so this, and we need state authority to forgive the loan because it's what the original rail authority. I assume that's the connection, the nexus for a couple of people are nodding their heads for legislative or statutory approval. So would this allow, is there any objection to this on the part of the authority?
Senator, again, Kyle Oldry. It's the authority that's requesting the loan be forgiven.
I'm sorry. I meant on the part of the, I mixed it up. On the part of the counties.
No, Senator. The counties also had part of the money to the authority, and we've already forgiven it to the authority, Senator.
What are the numbers?
Mr. Chair?
Sarah Olson.
So, Mr. Chair, is the amount here that is being forgiven just the state portion?
Yes. Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator, yes, ma'am.
Senator Dill.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, I've had a little experience with these short line railroads. going through Hutchinson. There's two of them that went in there, and it's very, very difficult to make ends meet. And I'm glad this railroad is still operating because a lot of them have shut down. And I would like to support this bill and make the appropriate motion when the time comes, if it's to go to the floor or wherever the appropriate next step is.
Sarah Roblin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm a little confused because in the fiscal note it says MnDOT has not received any payment on the loan, and it doesn't expect any repayment in the foreseeable future because the rail operator has no business prospects. But I'm understanding that you now have an ethanol plant that is a business prospect. So does that still preclude the line from being able to make a payment or any type of a payment?
Mr. Chair, Senator, what it does is it allows us enough traffic to survive but not to service any debt. When the original loan was written, the anticipated amount of car travel on the short line was about 3,000 cars, 2,500 to 3,000 cars. And that would have given us enough volume and cash flow to service the debt. However, by the ethanol plant coming on in the late 1990s, early 2000, our car travel is around 1,000 cars, so we don't generate enough traffic to service the debt. Does that answer
your question? Yes. Sarah Ferrickson.
Chairman, I have a couple of questions. This loan from the Minnesota Rail Service Improvement Program, the MRSI program, it was from the existing program, not a special appropriation?
I believe so, Senator. I have the agreements here, and I believe that's what it was called.
Mr. Chairman, I would be curious if we're going to hear from the department if we have forgiven other loans from this MRSI program, because this is a revolving loan program. It comes back to the state to make other loans. And I have another question. I was looking at the fiscal note we have, and the fiscal note says the total project was $2.3 million, with MnDOT contributing $1.49 million. And the bill that we have before us is something larger than that. I believe the bill says that the amount to be forgiven is $2.85 million. How do you reckon which is the correct amount, or what? How did you arrive at the $2.851 million?
Mr. Chair, there were two agreements. One was for the acquisition, and one was for the rehab. So it's the larger of the numbers. A portion, the $1.4 million, and I'll have to look. One was for the acquisition, $1.4 million, and then there was $1.4 million also for $1.45 million for the rehab. So there were two separate loans, and we're asking for forgiveness of both.
And Senator Fredrickson, relative to your question, your second question, I think the fiscal note talks about on page 3. Provides an answer. But further questions for Senator Vicomero's witnesses.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to know how I can get a loan that isn't really a loan someplace sometime. My budget could use it.
Talk to Senator Metzen when he comes back.
What does he have?
He's a banker.
Okay, further questions?
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Tomasoni.
Is there a difference between forgiving a loan or turning it into a grant? Is loan forgiveness or a loan becoming a grant different?
Well, as someone who has had not dissimilar legislation this year, I don't think so.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Murphy.
Mr. Chairman, we need to pass this bill and move along. These folks over here don't need to have the heavy boot of the state on the back of their neck in a time when they can't pay it back. They're just getting kind of their ethanol going down in that neck of the woods. And, you know, there may be some hope for that line, but not unless we pass this bill.
Mr. Chair.
Sir Roblin.
Is this now a publicly owned line, or are there any investors other than this in it?
Mr. Chair, Senator, it's owned by the two counties and as the rail authority. Nobles County and Rock County together formed, and then the shippers have members as well. So there's the shippers, and basically they were the elevators, formed a shippers association. So it's a shippers association along with the two counties that own it. And then we contract with an operator. Minnesota Southern operates it. And they're a private company. The rail, the operator's private, but the people that own the line are the two counties and the Shippers Association together.
So, Mr. Chair?
Sir Olin.
So if the line would ever become profitable, if the loans are forgiven and all, would the counties and the shippers be eligible for profit, if there's any profit?
I'd really love to have that problem, Senator. Yes, would be the short answer, but we don't see that happening. But they would come back to the two counties and the shippers at that point.
Okay.
So, Mr. Chairman?
Sarah Olson.
We have loaned money. They're not able to repay. So do we, if we don't forgive, what do we want to take over the railroad? I mean, if you just think of it in normal life, we took a risk, but we saw a value there. And we see some value in that continuing. But aren't we better off letting them run it than us?
Oh, by a long shot.
So I think that's my rationalization to getting to the same place that Senator Murphy is.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Dill.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that Senate File number 2462 be recommended to pass and be referred to the floor if that's the appropriate motion.
That would be.
Is the amendment put on?
Oh, I'm sorry. We have as amended, Senator Dill.
Mr. Chair, did anyone from MnDOT come to talk about the revolving loan fund, or have they just conceded that it isn't going to be able, they'll not be able to repay it, which the fiscal notes somewhat indicates?
Okay. I haven't received any requests to testify, but, sir, would you like to?
I can make a remark.
Sure.
Afternoon. My name is Bill Gardner with the Department of Transportation, Freight, Rail, and Waterway section. Our issue is not with this particular request. Frankly, it won't have a fiscal impact on our program. We haven't been receiving payments on the loan and don't anticipate any in the near future. Our concern is about precedent that it might set. We currently have about $6 million in outstanding loans to both rail authorities and to shippers. And that is our primary source of funding for the program. And since this bill's introduced, it's our understanding that the current balance of our loan fund is going to essentially be zeroed out in the next fiscal year to help with general budget purposes. So whether it's a grant program or a loan program is not of particular concern to us, as long as there is a long-term funding strategy for the program. The loan program works pretty well overall. Sometimes there's projects due to economic conditions that don't pan out. The loans aren't repaid. So that's essentially our concern here.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, how many other times have we had to forgive loans through the program?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I'm not aware of another instance that we have forgiven loans, but the program's been around for 30 years, so that would be before my time with the program, so I'm not completely certain.
Mr. Chairman?
Chair Berlin.
Do you anticipate having any other loans that would need to be forgiven?
Mr. Chair, Senator, we would anticipate that there might be others that would come before you seeking the same type of relief for whatever circumstance that they're in. Certainly, grants are more popular than loans.
Well, Mr. Chairman, do you anticipate anything in your portfolio at the present time would be a candidate for having a loan turned into a grant?
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes. Yes, we do. Yes, we would.
Mr. Chairman.
And how many would there be like that, and in what dollar amount?
Mr. Chair, Senator, we have about $6 million currently in outstanding loans. I would anticipate about half of that folks might come and seek relief on.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Berlin.
Does the department have some criteria when they make these loans as to, I'm sure you don't just make a loan to anybody. you must have some criteria that you use to have some assurance that the loan has a possibility of being repaid.
Mr. Chair, Senator, we do. We do a cost-benefit analysis. We look at projections for shipping, and the way the loans are typically structured is that the repayment is based on the amount of carloads that are generated, full carloads of product, as essentially an ability to pay over a long period of time. And shippers are involved, rail authorities are typically involved, and all parties, you know, concur with those projections. But over the long term, sometimes the economic conditions can shift radically in terms of the flows of grain, competition, trucking rates, and so forth.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, are these interest-free loans, or does interest no interest has accumulated on it? So if you do nothing, is there any consequence? There's no accumulated interest. But what is the consequence of not forgiving it and it just being there but unpaid?
Mr. Chair, Senator, essentially no consequence the way most of these loans are currently structured. Some do have a term limit on them where they would go into default and the state would retain an interest in that asset. But in this case, it's just sort of hanging out there, to be honest with you.
So Mr. Chairman, Mr. Gardner, are some of these other projects, there is such a thing that there, as you said, there's a state interest. In this case, it wouldn't be a consequence of taking over the railroad, but if they were going to abandon it, would and decided they couldn't function with it, it could become state property, or is that the case in part of the agreements and other loans?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I believe that's the case in virtually all of the loans, that there is a state interest. If it's no longer needed or used for railroad purposes, if it's abandoned formally through the Surface Transportation Board, then the state would have an interest in whatever it's sold for. A certain percentage of that would go to the state. In this case, there was also some federal funds originally assisting with the project, and they would have a certain percentage as well. And that's specified in the agreement.
So, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Gardner, there's some federal funds that went into this loan?
About $350,000 originally went into it.
So, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Gardner, is there any obligation that we would have in forgiving it related to the federal share?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I'm not certain about that. We would have to check, I think, with the Federal Railroad Administration about that. But I assume they would have an interest in that portion of it.
So, and Mr. Chairman, Mr. Gardner, they don't track that with any particular penalty. So, if they were required to be repaid, but they don't expect that, even with the non-payment through the state loan program, would you be better off just letting it continue as is rather than forgiving it?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I suspect that might be the case. It might flag the issue otherwise. From strictly that standpoint of the federal funding, the existing situation, there's no activity currently.
Okay. Hmm. Senator Roblin.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and Mr. Gardner, back to Senator Olson's line of questioning. If the line was vacated at some point and we had forgiven the loan, so then it would belong to whoever holds debt for the counties or the grain elevators and maybe the federal government, would we still be eligible to have any repayment if it would be sold out as parcels, or would our interest then be gone?
Mr. Chair, Senator, it's our understanding in talking to the Department of Finance that there would still be a state interest even with a forgiveness of the loan or conversion to a grant. I don't know exactly what form that would be or the amount, but that is our understanding.
That's okay.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Roblin.
And I'm, I know at one time trucking became the big way to ship grains, and just, in the recent years. But now with the costs of trucking going up, with, diesel fuel being over $4 a gallon, Do you think that there could be a resurgent in the elevator shipping that grain by rail, and that maybe they'll improve their lot in life and become profitable again?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I can't speak to the profitable part of it, but certainly there is significant increase in demand for rail. We know there are significant needs in terms of infrastructure on the rail system, and there's a certain amount of deferred maintenance that's occurred over the years. And so we certainly think there'd be a better opportunity to turn a profit, if you will, in the years ahead than there maybe have been in the years preceding.
Sure, you want
to also address that question. Part of the reason
if you can go back, if you can go back to the mic.
The mic.
Part of the reason we're not transporting grain anymore. Oh, I'm sorry, Kyle Oldry, Rock County Administrator. Part of the reason we're not transporting by rail anymore is because agriculture has evolved it. Now we're feeding it. It's a feed source, and our livestock industry has greatly expanded in Rock County. So it's not that they're moving grain to a different place by a different means. They're simply not moving grain. They're feeding it to either cattle or hogs, and then the ethanol plant takes a ton of our, or a lot more than a ton, but they take a considerable amount of our produced corn and turn it into ethanol. So there just isn't the grain available in Rock County to ship out anymore. It's just being used for other purposes. So that's really the reason we're not transporting it by rail anymore.
Sarah Foley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the things that's happened in many of those situations has been a conversion to some type of a trail or something. Is that a likely possibility, or do you see there's some way of continuing the rail movement of goods?
Mr. Chair, Senator, the county has zero interest in a trail at this point. Not that our plains aren't scenic, but we really, really, really need to move our ethanol by rail. And we did, the state worked with us a few years back, and we do have a trail from Laverne into the state park, Blue Mountain State Park, and up to the lake at Blue Mountain State Park. So I think our trail needs are met. What we really need is a rail line.
Mr. Chairman?
Sarah Olson.
Mr. Chairman, somebody that brought up or talked about the issue of if at some point things changed even with the ethanol industry, I mean, who knows in the future, and this loan was forgiven. We've forgiven apparently any interest in it in many other areas of whether it's land exchange or others. There's a reversionary clause that if at some point that is abandoned or not used for these purposes, that it would to the extent of the value of the forgiven loan, that would come back to the state. I wonder if there's anything to protect that corridor, if there's any language that could be added that would perhaps not only assure that would happen, but maybe be a deterrent to others seeking the loan if it meant that they'd end up ultimately giving up the land.
Okay. Further discussion. We have Senator Dill's motion in front of us. Is there further discussion on the motion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion carries. Thank you, Senator Vickerman.
Thank you, Mr.
Okay, let's,
Chair.
Let's go back to Senator Erickson Ropes.
Like it is.
Revert back to Senate File 1128.
Chairman, I'll move the A3 amendment.
We'll get us something good.
And then we give up our interest.
We can do that. Okay. You're right.
We
did that.
I would start making a big profit on it, then we're.
Try this again. Thank you again, Mr. Chair and committee members. I just would like to remind the committee again that as we're looking about cost containment for health care across the continuum, I think it's important for us to remember that caregiving is an important part of that. And we're realizing more and more that caregiving is taking care of your own children and then moves into taking care of your parents. And if we can allow employees to honestly take an extra day off in the name of their parent, we are going to be actually prospectively saving the health care costs in our public programs. Because right now, if an employee does not get time off, they have to call
public services, or we wind up paying for transportation, and we really just cost shift back to state programs. So if we can do anything to help families take care of their own family members, keep them in their homes longer, I think it's a good thing not only for the family, the well-being of the patient, but it actually is good for the economics of our state programs.
Mr. Chairman, I'll move the E3 amendment. Mr. Chairman?
I'll move
the A3 amendment.
Okay. And I indicated Senator Erickson Ropes, we have some discussion on the bill before we vote on the amendment. Why don't we finish discussion on the amendment then? Senator Stumpf.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I think it's definitely a good idea, but I do want to ask a few questions, and one of them is when you look at the fiscal note, and I guess
is this on the amendment?
No, if you want to put the amendment on.
Yeah, that's what we have in front of us right now. Is there further discussion on the A3 amendment?
Chairman?
Senator Frederickson.
One small detail I asked Mr. Watson. On line 5, do we need the word for?
No.
Just say provided under this.
Provided under.
This section.
Mr. Chairman, this is
Mr. Chairman,
such.
Senator Frederickson, I don't follow you. There's a nor there. Are you suggesting that be
something?
Before.
Provided and under.
Provided under this section.
Mm-hmm. Before that, Mr. Watson.
Provided for under.
It's right here.
Different. Mr. Chairman, I don't know.
We have a very inconclusive opinion from Mr. Watson. What do you want to do, Senator Frederickson?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Thomas.
That are provided for under this section.
Or provided under this section.
Provided under this section.
It's a friendly amendment either way.
Maybe we could have one voice on the amendment.
Chairman, Senator Thomasoni, would you incorporate in your?
No, I like the four.
I do too.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Watson.
Mr. Chairman, I think the provided for is appropriate because the benefits are not actually provided in the section. It's the benefits are provided in the employer's policy, and the law is telling the employer what has to be in the policy.
Mr. Watson, you're reading Senator Thomasoni's mind. That's exactly what he was thinking, I believe.
That's what I was thinking.
All right. We have the A3 amendment in front of us. Is there further discussion on the A3 amendment? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Then on the bill, Senator Stumpf.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And first of all, the question is on we're amending Section 181 or Chapter 181, 0.9. And Mr. Watson, is that a city and county chapter?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Stumpf, no. It applies to all employers, I believe.
Okay.
Yes.
Then my question, Mr. Chairman, is when we look at the fiscal note under the local fiscal impact, we have counties and cities, but certainly one other very large local government is our schools and our school districts. And there is no fiscal note for that fairly large segment of our local government.
Which does require substitutes.
Mm-hmm. So I would like to see the fiscal impact on our local school districts. If that just got overlooked or what.
Mr. Chair and Senator Stumpf, we didn't write the local impact notes. You'll have to talk to the department about that.
Okay.
And Mr. Chairman?
Sarah Olson.
And Mr. Chairman, what about hospitals? All the health care ones that would probably have to replace if employees are missing. Are they covered? It was the expansiveness of it that I was uncertain of it as well.
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, if a county runs a hospital, I would assume that the fiscal impact note would cover, they would be speaking on behalf of all the sectors of employment that they have.
But Mr. Chairman,
Olson.
Hospitals aren't always run by counties, are they? Any independent hospital or any chain, or they're all nonprofits, are they covered under this section of law?
Mr. Chair and Major Senator hospitals? Olson, the answer is yes.
Okay.
Further discussions on the bill?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Fredrickson.
Chairman, on page 1, line 10, delete such, and after periods, insert of time. So I would read, for reasonable periods of time as the employee's attendance may be met.
I didn't hear. So you don't need the of time.
On Senator Fredrickson's motion, is there further discussion?
Where are we looking?
Okay.
Do you want to repeat that? It's on the bill itself.
Mr. Chairman, line 10, delete such. After the word periods, insert of time. So that phrase would read, for reasonable periods of time as the employee's attendance.
Any discussion on that amendment of Senator Ferguson? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, did we adopt the division report and then amend it?
Yes.
Okay. And then is it time to move the bill as amended now?
If you wish to do so, I think Senator Roebling would like to.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I really don't have a problem with local units of government extending this benefit to their employees. What I have a problem with is us mandating it. And I just am kind of an anti-mandate person as far as many of these things go. And I would wish that everybody would build this into their contracts, into their pay agreements. But we actually don't know how much trouble this is going to cause some of the local units of government. And as Senator Stumpf pointed out, if it affects schools and more teachers take off, we have to pay more substitutes. We know substitutes are not as effective in the classroom as regular teachers. And so I would rather leave that decision up to the local units of government to make and negotiate. And I hope they do. I would want them to do that. I realize that it's easier for AARP or the Alzheimer's Association to come to the state and ask us to do it, because then it's a one-stop shop. But it would be better done visiting these local units of government and impressing upon them, the benefits to the employees and families instead of coming to us. And so it is kind of hard to vote against, but I'm going to vote against it because I just think this is not the place where we should take care of it all in one fell swoop.
Mr. Chair and Senator Roebling, thank you very much. I do appreciate what you're saying. I think everyone here is very sensitive to local control issues and passing on expenses. However, again, from our state's perspective here, one of the things we're trying to do is implement cost containment strategies for healthcare costs that are getting out of control. And this is one strategy that's recommended to do that and provides family benefits as well as state benefits. So in the overall picture, I think it's a good thing for the state of Minnesota.
Further discussion on the bill.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Stumpf.
Just a note. I do want to see some kind of a fiscal note on the impact. And it is a negotiated benefit, but I think the purpose is definitely good, and it's like Senator Roebling said, it's a very difficult thing to understand. But we do, as a legislative body, pass along a tremendous amount of costs onto our local units of government. Just to give you a quick note, back in 2002, we had a $870 million property tax reduction per year. Now, in 2009, we're going to have about $1.7 or $1.8 billion increase since 2002. All of that property tax increase is basically being responsibilities moved back onto local property owners. And at a time when the legislature is pretty much hamstrung in terms of money, I think people are too, which is really the sad thing, is that individuals and individual families are struggling too. But, you know, I definitely would like the information before I support it.
Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chair, and to respond to Senator Stumpf, if there is another fiscal note that comes forward on this bill, if we get more information before this goes to the floor, I mean, I support this bill, and I raised some questions about the fiscal note already, but I think that if there is further work done on it, we need to really have, I think, a more accurate description of the fiscal impact, because this, I think, is really incomplete, because it doesn't talk about if employees don't use their sick leave, what's the cost there? Because, you know, if it's rolled over to retirement and then they have to pay them a lump sum at the end of their wages, is that based on their higher earning capacity? And, you know, what is that in today's dollars? And who knows? And also, you know, how many, in the terms of school districts, how many of the collective bargaining agreements already provide these rights for teachers would be another question. We really don't have information about that. And I would suspect a lot of them probably do already allow this, but I don't know for a fact.
Not to that extent.
So I find it frustrating here that we have a fiscal note that I think is incomplete because it doesn't really compare apples to apples in terms of giving us all the information.
Well, Senator Anderson, this is the fiscal note we have. If members wish to take action, obviously the bill leaves here and goes to the floor. So I don't know if you want to make a request for a fiscal note for further action on the floor or keep it in the committee.
Mr. Chair, as I said, I strongly support this bill. I'd like us to pass it today. I was just responding to Senator Stumpf, who said he'd like to see a more detailed or a follow-up fiscal note. And I presume he was talking about before this comes up on the floor or as the bill moves forward in the process. And I was just asking for detail on that.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Anderson, yes. You know, I think it would be a bit presumptuous and foolish on our part to pass this on the floor without having actually, you know, the information as to who it's going to impact. You know, all through the session we've been talking about trying to, at least in our education committee, trying to not pass unfunded mandates onto our local units of government because we basically are cutting budgets to begin with. And it's such a worthy cause and such a good purpose, but at the same time, I think we should make a decision with information and not,
We've had a pretty full discussion of this. Ms. Freeman, is there something?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Senator Stumpf, Iris Freeman again from the Alzheimer's Association. To Senator Anderson's point, if there is more information to be considered before or in a floor debate, we also need to look at the data about family caregivers who are so stretched between their workplaces and their jobs that they're quitting and their employers are having to run to advertise to orient and train new employees. So there are many, many cost issues here. On balance, we believe this is the best social policy.
Mr. Chairman?
Sarah Olson.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Freeman. Knowing the challenges of dealing with Alzheimer's, it seems to me that what one's sick leave is such a drop in the bucket that it really I have a hard time comprehending how it could amount to a great savings. Taking somebody to a doctor's appointment is not the challenge of care. I've done it. I've juggled it, and I've hired extra help to be able to handle it as well because there's no way that sick leave is going to deal with if you have somebody that you'd like to maintain their care in the home and they need this. This is not going to do it. And particularly the range of even the level of the grandparent or step-parent, one could say you could see it maybe with spouse and parent, and I'm not sure why you didn't stop there. But going on to, you know, brothers and sisters and all of the rest, I'm not sure if that doesn't actually make weaken the potential of any savings.
Senator Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, most of the time when families are afflicted with a disease like Alzheimer's or any other long-term debilitating disease, it's a family event, and you have aunts, uncles, cousins, brothers, third cousins, neighbors, people down the street, mayor of Red Wing, for example, come by and lend a hand. It's a group effort. And so if you have one person that works at one of these governmental facilities that can donate a day of their time to help provide care to one of these individuals, just one day a month, it takes a lot of pressure off the rest of the people in that family tree. And it's, I can tell you from firsthand experience, it's not a treat. And unless you have everybody in the tree working to provide the services that the individual needs, it's not going to work. And this is only going to work if we have all those people working together. And I think that most families, when there is a disease or an illness like Alzheimer's, they all pitch in together. So I think this bill is ready to go.
Mr. Chairman.
Period.
Senator Thomas Honey.
Mr. Chairman, unless I misunderstand, I can understand this, and correct me if I'm wrong. This bill does not grant one extra day of sick leave that already isn't out there, nor does it make anybody who isn't giving sick leave give sick leave. Is that correct?
That's correct, Senator.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I'll move the bill.
Okay, do we have any further discussion on the bill? Anybody wish to take any action or?
I just moved it.
Oh, that's right. Senator Tomasoni.
10 minutes ago, but moved it again.
Fair enough. Senator Tomasoni moves that Senate File 1128 as amended be recommended to pass. Further discussion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion carries.
Thank you,
Senator X.
Thank you very much.
Senator Sharon. Senate File 3140.
Thank you, Chair Cohen. We have an amendment, the A8 amendment.
Senator Tomasoni moves adoption of the division report. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion
no.
carries.
I just threw it away. Mr. Chairman, in all seriousness, though, there is a subdivision in this bill that needs to come out.
There is.
All right, we'll see. Senator Sharon, we're having distributed the A8 amendment, but
okay, so.
Does this amend the division report?
The A8 amendment?
Or it amends the engrossment?
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Watson?
It amends the committee engrossment because the division report amendments have been engrossed into the bill.
Okay.
If you want to see how it affects the division report, on the division report, it's page 1, lines 26 to 29. So it is a change to something that was done in the division.
Okay, so before we adopt this amendment, Senator Sharon, why are we doing this?
This particular language in the amendment came as a request of IBEW in order to make certain that the language was written in a way that the bill itself would not interfere with an already existing labor contract. So only the public utilities, cooperative elective associations, et cetera, who are subject to an existing labor contract may utilize provisional licenses, provided there's no violation of the existing contract. That's the essence that IBEW wanted to be crystally clear about.
Does anybody wish to move the amendment? I think, Sarah Tomasoni, you moved. Or maybe not.
What am I doing?
Move the amendment.
I thought he moved it.
There's a request for the A8 amendment.
I would love to move it.
Senator Metzen moves adoption of the amendment. Is there further discussion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Senator Sharon.
Yes, thank you. This is a bill that started about a year ago. I'll just give you a little background on it. It was brought to the Department of Employment and Economic Development as a result of meetings that occurred with employers around the state. In that discussion, it was became clear that there were not enough boiler operators in the 1A class, the first class 1A boiler to supply the demand, probably because of the growth in the ethanol and biodiesel plants. The employers thought that the Department of Labor and Industry ought to make a review and changes to the current licensing requirements. and somehow shorten the length of time to acquire the first-class 1A license. An employee, as a matter of fact, of the Department of Employment and Economic Development, and I think this is an impressive story, picked this up at a meeting and then made calls around to industry and found out that there were 200 different industries that indicated that they were experiencing difficulties in this area. So as a result of that, we had a public forum, a public meeting, in which we invited members of the union laborers, of the industry association leaders, Department of Employment and Economic Development, myself and Representative Gunther, and members of the educational system at MNSCU to come together to discuss the issue and to determine what might be occurring and what the solutions might be. The outcome of that meeting of license holders as well as industry leaders indicated that there were not enough first-class 1A boiler operators to keep up with the supply and demand, due largely to the growth and the expansion of the ethanol and biodiesel industries due to retirements and the time that it takes to acquire the first-class 1A license. And the second issue was the current regulations had not kept up with the industry technology advancements. So it was encouraged that we'd have to review these current regulations. As a result of this meeting last summer, of all of these players, the Department of Labor and Industry agreed it was not an agency-initiated bill, but the agency, DALI, agreed to pull together various stakeholders from all of these groups. There was a 20-member advisory group that came together from these various sectors to take a look at the issue and to make some recommendations. And that essentially is what is in front of you, is the outcome of this work group that met over the summer. I really appreciate the fact that the stakeholders have worked long. And even during this session, many of the different organizations that have an interest in this have come forward and met with us, and we've modified and changed the language as it has moved through the different different committees. So with that, you can see that from the, you should have a fiscal note that the boiler operator licensing procedure modifications do not have any indication of a cost to the state because the costs of the program are absorbed by a fee, a $50 fee upon application. And I'd be glad to answer any further questions that you may have about the bill.
Senator Murphy.
Well, Mr. Chairman, here's I'm going to make a motion. Mr. Chairman, on page 6, I would like to remove subdivision 16. That's lines 25 through 28.
Excuse me, do I have
this? I can understand why this bill is here. You know, I disagree with my IBEW brothers and sisters in regards to the overall scope of the bill. I don't believe that there should be provisional licenses in this area for anything. Because I've seen what happens when you put people who are inexperienced and you let them tag along with someone who does have a chief or a first-class license. And then pretty soon, and I understand why the employers brought this to you, Senator, because pretty soon the employer comes down, they grab the dude on the provisional license, and they say, hey, we got another job for you to do at the other end of the plant. Now they're working unsupervised. Now, I know that this says that they have to be supervised, but sometimes to the employer, supervision means that, okay, somebody does have a chief's license that is at this plant, but just because they're in the control room and the dude on the provisional license is working in the basement, I don't see how we can, I just don't see how that we can do that. But I understand we need more boiler operators, and sometimes it's difficult to get a license. But the part that you can't replace with educational training is experience. And I am very wary of giving a commissioner, doesn't matter who it is, the right to establish rules to bring in some sort of educational equivalency. And Senator Anderson, you better listen up here, because they did the same thing when it comes to you have to have a license to burn garbage, okay, at an RDF plant. Everybody has to have these licenses, right? Well, now what they've done, instead of saying that you have to have X amount of hours of experience, have a boiler's operator's license, blah, 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 they've said You can vacate all that if you have 16 or 26 hours of educational experience. It's got nothing to do with knowing how to run a plant safely, how to run it efficiently. Experience in this area is everything. You're talking about, you know, and you look through this, and it looks like the person on the provisional license, you know, and don't get me wrong, nobody is going to put that person or risk the plant. They're not going to put them in an unsafe situation. At least the person that holds the license, the person with the chief engineer's license, is the guy that's on the hook, Senator Cohen. It's not the company. It's the guy that has the license. Now, I don't think the licensed employee is going to put another employee at risk, okay? But that doesn't mean that as soon as their back's not turned that somebody doesn't come along and say, hey, provisional license, come with me. I've got a job for you to do, and then gets them hurt. I've seen it happen.
Same thing happened with this certificate we had to burn down.
They brought in these educational requirements. Okay, that meets everything. But these, you know, okay, you read the book, you know what dioxins and furans are, but you don't know how they are, how they're scavenged from the back end of the boiler so that they don't go out the stack.
No, it reads A.
You don't know what a scrubber's for.
You don't know what
ESP is, and this is not mind reading, it's electrostatic precipitator. You don't learn those things from the book. You learn them from putting your feet on the ground and your hands on the tool. And no amount of book work is going to fill in for that experience. I think if we're going to have a provisional license, we need to have that person out on the job site working with that chief engineer or first class. And that's why those classes were always put in there, is because you get your second class, you move up to first class after 2 years, I believe, and then you can move up to a chief's after you've gained 5 years of experience. That's what it's all about. And, you know, you talk to a lot of people that got out of the Navy back before they went nuclear. And now before they used nuclear power as their power source, back when they, you know, burned fuel oil, and they had huge boilers, and you talk to any of those people, and a lot of people that have Navy experiences have seen the videotape of what happens when you take a high-pressure boiler and you gag one of the relief valves so that it blows up. You can sink a ship in about 2 minutes. And I don't know. I just don't think that the educational component, Senator, makes up for the experience. But, you know, I understand the thrust of the overall bill. I still have heartburn, but you know what? I'm retired, so.
Okay. Senator Sharon?
Thank you. I think that Senator Murphy has expressed a number of issues, but I would draw the committee's attention to the fact that the language was changed in this last approved amendment that says that the educational office offset – this is on page 6, between lines 25 to 28, which is the section that Senator Murphy is referring to. It changes it. Instead of saying all, it just is a portion of the specified operating experience. And this process that we've been through in terms of bringing this piece of legislation forward has involved a number of not just industry, but also license holders, people who are representing people who have license holders, and the educational systems. So Joel Amato, who works with the, it would be the Dolly, was really very reluctant to move forward because of safety issues and concerns over which that organization is responsible to taking a look at this, but did agree at the request of this summer group to pull together a group of stakeholders. And certainly the issue of safety and making certain that safety issues were still achieved within the context of this legislation, it was his responsibility to make certain that those elements of this licensing process would be preserved. So, you know, the questions that Senator Murphy raised were raised throughout the entire process in terms of determining how could we go about creating a temporary license, and there are limitations on the temporary license. It can only be renewed twice. It has a limitation to it, and it can only occur, the number of them is restricted and limited to the number of licenses that are actually for supervision purposes in the industry itself.
Mr. Chairman. Further, Sarah Olson.
Mr. Chairman, the provision that Senator Murphy is moving to remove, that rulemaking is it the ordinary rulemaking process? It's not an expedited rulemaking process, presume. So you'd have to go through the statement of need and reasonableness. You'd have to have all of that input, go before an administrative law judge. I presume it would be contested so that you would have that full procedure. And have all of that input. So it would seem, are there enough checks and balances to what might be proposed as an equivalence that would assure the safety and other kinds of needs of this? I mean, that's not a piece of cake going through that rulemaking process.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you, Senator. I have with me John Rakowski, and I would request that you would allow him to speak to the senator's questions.
Okay. Mr. Rakowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I wish that our Chief Boiler Inspector Joel Amato was here. He does come out of the Navy and would appreciate your comments. My understanding, and he's
Mr. Rakowski, if you could just identify yourself for the record.
John Rakowski with the Department of Labor and Industry, I apologize. There has been no mention of expedited rulemaking on the educational requirements that you're referring to, Senator Olson. So I'm going to say it would go through the regular rulemaking process that you referred to. And if I may, for Senator Murphy's benefit, before Mr. Amato left town, he's at a conference, this amendment was offered by the representative of the Boilermakers Local 70. So labor unions have had input on this a lot.
Yeah,
Sir Murphy.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Rakowski, there's a huge difference between a boiler maker and a boiler operator.
Okay. Well, just identifying the union maker.
Mr. Chairman.
But Mr. Chairman, my contention remains, and if Mr. Amato was here, I'm sure that he would be able to come to the testifiers table and tell you that in the Navy, it's hands-on training, along with book learning. I mean, you know, it works well together, but if you only have one part and not the other, they don't seem to work very well. But it says here that the applicant may meet instead of all or any portion of the specific operating experience.
It's A. That's changed.
That's the amendment. I'm sorry, Senator.
Okay. So it's... It's not all.
No.
It's only a portion.
A portion. Yeah.
All right. Well, I guess I'll take my Mount St. Helens road tour back on the road then.
And that means, Senator Murphy?
That he's going to move it.
That means that I will withdraw my motion. Okay. I must have. I don't think I have the engrossed version here in front of me. Sorry about that. But I'm sure that if Mr. Romano was here, he'd agree with me.
Absolutely, Mr. Chairman, he would.
I'm sure he would. And thank goodness that the Marine Corps had all those sailors to drive us around wherever we needed to be.
Okay.
But you moved.
Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair.
Steve.
I'm looking at the bottom of page 2, and it says that no person is eligible for a provisional license for use of at all these different kinds of facilities, and I can't figure out what other kind of facilities they would then be able to be used for. So maybe Mr. Rakowski would know. What other kind of facility is there other than a public utility, a cooperative electric association, a generation and transmission cooperative electric association, a muni power agency, or a muni electric utility? What else is there?
A boat on the Mississippi.
A boat on the Mississippi.
Sarah Sharon.
Thank you. I would just say that this no language also has been amended in the last amendment. So it reads.
She should be looking at the
through here. It's
A8 amendment.
Only. It reads only instead of no. Only public utilities, et cetera. So it's not no any longer. It's only. And schools, hospitals, ethanol plants, those might be examples of other places where you would have utilities, where you would have boiler operators.
So, Mr. Chair,
Senator Higgins.
Senator Sharon, that's changed like 180 degrees from the original to the amendment. It's gone from saying that nobody can use them in these facilities to saying that only these facilities can use these provisional licenses. So it's gone 180 degrees different?
It says the same thing, only in the positive rather than in the negative.
No, it doesn't.
Yeah, that's, I'm not fine.
Are we talking about two different things?
I'm talking about page 2, the bottom, and the amendment. The original committee engrossment says that no one is eligible for a provisional license to use at any of these list of facilities. And your amendment now says that only this same list of facilities can use provisional licensed operators.
It's true.
And that might be the right, I mean, that may be what you want to do, and not the ethanol plants and not the school boilers and all those kinds of things. But it's kind of a...
Sarah Sharon?
I am unclear to the... I'm just a little unclear. I know that this language is the language that was agreed upon by IBEW.
And I don't.
And perhaps... Dan, would you like to come up and speak to this?
Thank you.
Okay. Can you help?
And then I have another question when we figure this one out.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Dan Pfeiffer with Xcel Energy. We worked with the unions to put this language together. The original language, Senator, in the bill had sort of an unforeseen consequence. We typically... have senior boiler operators at our plants, and if they leave the company, if they retire, we will typically go down and bring the next union operator up under a provisional license while he's being trained in with the experience and the training that we offer to make him the senior operator. This language that you're reading here in the engrossment inadvertently exempted us from using that practice, which we've been using with the unions for some time. So the amendment corrects this to say that as long as we have a labor agreement in place and that we're abiding by that labor agreement, we may use a provisional license for a boiler operator.
Sarah Olson.
Mr. Chairman, I was trying to find what Senator Sharon had responded to at Senator Murphy's concern that all had been removed, and I cannot find that. On this amendment. Okay. I'm sorry. Thank you.
All right. Further discussion on the bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair, another question.
Okay, Senator Higgins.
I still think the answer isn't dealing with the words that are actually in the amendment, but whatever. Now I'm looking at the top of page 3 of the committee engrossment. Paragraph F says that each provisional license expires in 36 months, and it may not be renewed. Then the next paragraph says the commissioner may issue no more than 2 provisional licenses to any person within a 4-year period. So how would that actually work? Your 36-month provisional license would expire, and then you have to wait a couple of months or a couple of weeks or a couple of days to get a new one because you can't renew it, and then you'd have to just get a new one? Or are there different types of provisional licenses that one person could get during a four-year period?
Sarah Sharon.
I wonder. The provisional, thank you, Senator. The provisional license is not given to the individual license holder, but it's I think it's provided to the Class A license holder.
To the business.
Then how does 3.5 work in there, license to an individual? Sorry, Mr. Chair.
Hey, further discussion?
Senator. Well, that was a question.
It's a question I don't have an answer to yet.
Mr. Chairman, I think I can offer, I'm not real familiar with this language, but I think what this is saying is that the expectation is that once the provisional license expires after 36 months, that person will have moved up to obtain the full licensing. Mm-hmm. Therefore, the provisional license wouldn't be needed anymore. And that's why there's a time limit put on that, and then there's a limit put on the number of provisional licenses that a person could hold.
Senator Murphy, can you help? Yeah, and Mr. Chairman, Senator Higgins, that's pretty basic on how they do all these licenses. The provisional license appears to me this is an entry level. You work under that license for a period of up to X amount of months. By that time, you should have enough experience so that you could sit for the second class license. Once you get your second class license and you get a couple years of experience under your belt, you can get another. You have to get an affidavit signed by a chief engineer saying that you've done 2 years of experience under their tutelage, and then you can go up to the department and see the department. You can sit for your first class. And after you get your first class, then you have to wait a little bit of time, gain some more experience. And after you have 5 years of experience, then you can go sit for your chief's test. And there's two different tests that they give there. You know, you have your A license and B license. And once you get to a chief engineer level, if you have a grade A license that allows you to operate boilers and turbines of unlimited horsepower, and a B is for only boilers, I believe, or it's vice versa. I forget now. It's been 45 days since I was retired, so I checked out on all that. But this kind of fits with that, that methodical progression on up the chart. So I can see, and I understand why businesses need to have a little bit of flexibility in this regard. It is difficult to get enough experience to sit for your second class license. So I can understand why this is. I just, it's a lot easier for most of the people that are in that industry to learn by doing and using their hands and instead of just sitting in a classroom for, 40 hours of instruction or whatever.
Ms. Sharon.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you. And sorry, Senator Higgins, I'm getting a little oriented to your question. The other issue that that everyone wanted to make certain didn't happen, we wanted this progression to occur, that the person would use this and then move forward with an educational process to get the appropriate level of licensure, rather than allowing an individual to move around from place to place and sustain themselves as an individual simply operating out of this provisional license, that it would prohibit a person from changing places of employment and doing provisional licenses without that individual being encouraged to move up the line and get the proper licensure that is necessary.
So you, Mr. Chair, so what you're saying, Senator Sharon, is that if you had a provisional license at Company A and yet then you moved to a different company with the idea of moving up the ladder, if it had been less than – if it had been under a certain period of time, you couldn't have another provisional license at Company B. Is that what you're saying?
That the individual couldn't do this more than twice.
Yeah. Okay. All right. I'm sorry.
Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Is there further discussion? We're probably going to have to lay over Senator Higgins' bill. Mine will take three minutes. Well, Senator Tomasoni?
Well, Mr. Chairman, back to the amendment again. I'm noticing that on page 2, line 15, it says, except as provided in paragraph E. And then when we get to paragraph E, it says, only public utilities may utilize provision license for operators. Does that then mean that parts 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6 are not applicable now because it says only public utilities?
That's why we're having trouble with this bill. Sarah Sharon, let me just remind members, this is the Finance Committee, but Sarah Sharon, go ahead.
You know, I appreciate the questions because I know the intent of the language is in this particular section is to speak to resolving any unintended consequences that would occur in those organizations that already have labor, negotiated labor agreements to deal with provisional licenses. So maybe I'll have to look at that to make sure it's not nullifying the rest of the bill.
Well, it might be because it says except as in paragraph E, and then paragraph E says only public utilities may utilize.
Has anybody moved the bill yet, Mr. Chair?
No, Senator Evans.
I would do that to put Senator Sharon out of her agony. No, I still don't understand it.
So, Senator Frederickson.
I don't know if anybody can answer it here because...
Yeah, you need to look into
it. I'm not sure I was following it.
If you look on line 215.
Which line again? I'm sorry.
215.
215.
Says except as provided in paragraph E. Then it's got six places where you can use the provisional licenses. But then when you get to the amendment, which is paragraph E, it says only public utilities may utilize the provisional licenses, which would be paragraph E. And I'm wondering if that language effectively nullifies 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, and 6.
Well, Mr. Chairman? Mm-hmm.
Senator Olson.
Is that attempting to assure that they're working under supervision, that places that may just have one boiler operator can't hire somebody with a provisional? Because, I mean, it's they've got to be under subject to enlisting existing labor contract. There's some pretty definitive language in that.
I guess, Senator, I can't answer the question. I would have to have someone more expert than me. But certainly we want to make sure that...
We know the intent.
We want to make sure that the intent comes through, absolutely.
Well, if members are uncertain as to what they'd like to do...
We can move the bill, Mr. Chairman, as long as we find out what this actually all means before it gets passed so it doesn't screw everything up.
And maybe once everything gets engrossed, it'll be easier to understand.
Well, if there are questions, we can. The bill came originally from where?
Mr. Chairman?
The Sony's division.
And before that, what, Senator Medson's committee?
It's been through Senator Medson's committee.
If they haven't done the work in Senator Medson's committee. Senator Frederickson?
This is a new amendment that we didn't see before.
Senator Frederickson?
Mr. Chairman, there's several places where the use of such is inappropriately used, and it's the same in all these... licensure sections. I'm going to move to replace such with the. So on page, I wouldn't do it if there weren't already changes being made in all of these sections anyway, so it would be a good time to clean it up. Page 4, lines 5, 18, 26, 35, and on page 5, line 8, 17, 26, and 36, delete such and insert the.
Okay, we have the Frederickson motion in front of us for the discussion. If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed. Motion carries. Further discussion on the bill. Anybody wish to take any action?
I moved it already.
Okay, Senator Higgins moves that Senate File 3140 as amended be recommended to pass. Is there further discussion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed. Motion carries. Thank you, Senator Sharon. Okay, then, promising this is going to take a couple minutes, we have Senate File 3073, Senator Higgins. Senator Tomasoni moves adoption of the division report. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed. Motion carries. Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, last year when we were working on the foreclosure and predatory lending bills, I kept seeing... What we need is a fund where we can just catch people up when they've gotten behind in their mortgages, if they can go forward once they've been caught up. And lo and behold, we actually have a fund that can help do that. And I didn't know it until we started working on this bill. This is a fund that's in in MHFA, and... What the bill does is change the amount that is able to be loaned to the homeowner to more accurately reflect the amount of people's mortgages these days. It is a no-interest loan, a no-interest deferred loan, and back in like 2001, the last time it was increased, it was set as a possible 6 months of the person's mortgage or contract for deed payment, with a cap of $5,500, and we now know that that cap is woefully inadequate. So this raises it to what would in effect be a little over $10,000 for metro area and a little over $9,000 for homeowners elsewhere in the state. And then the formula now allows for annual updates to reflect the vagaries of how much people are paying for their mortgages. And we are able to do this because Marquette Bank made a grant to MHFA for $500,000 to help help implement this section. And homeowners are able to access this fund through the Mortgage Foreclosure Prevention Counselor system that we have here and there throughout the state.
Sounds good.
And it has no fiscal impact.
Mr. Chairman, that makes it a great bill. I'll move the bill.
Yes. It's my bill.
Before we do that, Senator,
move our own bill.
Sorry.
Senator Higgins, apparently the House files come over. Do you want to move?
Do I move the House file then?
Yep. Or substitution of the House file for the Senate file?
They're identical, so if that's what we need to do, that's what we should just do.
I don't care where it came from.
They're identical.
Okay, they're identical, so just move the House file.
Okay, then. Mr. Chair, I move that House file 3346 be recommended to pass.
Mr. Chair, just one quick question.
Senator Roblin.
I know you said that there was more money in the loan fund. But will we still be able to do approximately the same number of loans with the additional money, even though we've doubled the amount that can be used for any single homeowner?
Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling, I'm Tanya Orr from the Housing Finance Agency, and the amount of money that we got from Marquette Bank actually doubles the amount of money available for financial assistance, and this is a revolving fund. So people pay it back when it's no longer their home, so this fund keeps growing.
Further discussion on Senator Higgins' motion that House File 3346 be recommended to pass.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Orr, so how do people find out about this loan fund?
Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, the money is available through the Foreclosure Prevention Counseling Network, which is their counselors all over the state. So if they go to a counselor to ask for help figuring out how to get themselves out of a problem, this is one of the tools that the counselors can make available to them.
And Mr. Chairman, are those counselors then through the Housing Finance Agency or through the local government?
Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, they are actually through a nonprofit, a series of nonprofits, Lutheran Social Services, sometimes the CAP, the Homeownership Center, their neighborhood organizations. So it's a variety of organizations that have had people trained, and there's a network that's supervised by the Homeownership Center.
Okay, let me be more specific. If I want to write about this in my newsletter and tell my constituents who to call, how do I find out that information?
Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas.
Tanya Orr, 296.
Yes, that's what I wanted. Tanya Orr, 296.
Lutheran Social Services.
The Homeownership Center.
Is there one in St. Paul?
There's, yes, there are. But if they go to the Homeownership Center website, that'll tell them where to go.
Okay, thanks.
HOC. All right, Senator Higgins moves that House File 3346 be recommended to pass. Is there further discussion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Aye.